Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, when Nixon met Mao in China, what can we learn today from that week that changed the world? But first, Vice President Dick Cheney said today, it's a sign things are going well. A British lawmaker, though, said, we're leaving a region less stable than when we arrived. That's some of the reaction to this morning's announcement from Prime Minister Tony Blair that British fighters will begin withdrawing from the southern Iraqi city of Basra in the coming months if Iraqi forces can secure the area.
The actual reduction in forces will be from the present 7,100, itself down from over 9,000 2 years ago, and 40,000 at the time of the conflict, to roughly 5,500.
Blair said the problems in Basra remain formidable, but conditions there are better than in Baghdad, where what he called an orgy of terrorism exists. Joining us on the line now, Stryker McGuire, London bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. And Stryker, just last month, Prime Minister Blair criticized a proposal to withdraw British troops by October. He called it irresponsible then. What changed?
Not a lot, actually. First of all, he's not putting a sort of final date on withdrawal, and he would never want to do that. You know, he would never want to say we're going to be out of there by a certain date. This plan to draw down the number of troops is something that's been talked about since last year. It got serious quite recently. In fact, it got serious at about the same time as people in the United States were getting serious about a surge in troops in Baghdad, which is why I suspect it must sound a little curious to people in the United States that the Brits are pulling out, albeit very slowly.
Right. This is also coming as Blair is due to step down after a decade in office.
Yes, and it's not totally unconnected. I mean, I think he's certainly not doing this just because he is on his way out, but it is convenient and it's politically helpful to him because it begins to look like a job done in Basra, even though it's not entirely over with.
Well, and that's sort of how Vice President Dick Cheney characterized it, again, saying things are going pretty well, and, you know, that would, you know, be the proof that British troops are leaving. But Basra still has competing Shiite militias. There's no British embassy or UN presence there because of the violence. It's sort of the no-go, no-man's land. So are people in Britain saying this is Britain acknowledging defeat?
Certainly critics of the Prime Minister might well be saying that. The government view here is that the situation is getting under control, and they are leaving it in the hands of Iraqi troops. That their argument is that those Iraqi troops are getting trained, that they're up to speed, and that they can take over, and that the British troops can move into a position of supporting the Iraqis.
Well, as you point out, Prime Minister Blair also said the role of British troops now would be to pull back to an air base, be there when called, if needed, by the Iraqi forces. But meanwhile, the Danish Prime Minister also announced today that 460 Danish troops under British command in southern Iraq will leave by August. Lithuanian leaders said for the first time they're considering withdrawing their 53 troops from Iraq. Italian troops withdrew last year. And this is as Dick Cheney is on a trip to Japan and Australia, two of Washington's other valuable allies in the war on terror. So what is your sense of how the coalition is holding together?
Well, you know, it's never been quite the coalition it was portrayed, even in the early days. I think at one point there were, you know, over 30 countries that were supposedly part of the coalition. Some of that support was nominal, and some of it was with serious troops. But in fact, many European countries, the Italians, the Spaniards, have pulled out. They were big, important contingents. They're out of there. Now the Brits are pulling out. And, you know, someday, you'll have stories in the United States about the Americans pulling out. And even then, the security situation will probably be dicey in Baghdad.
Is there any sense of U.S. troops being needed to go into the south to fill the vacuum perhaps left by the Brits?
There is not. And if there were that sense, then I think this whole plan would be much more problematic from the American point of view, and it would be much more controversial than it is, because the U.S. simply cannot afford to send its troops anywhere else than where they already are in Iraq.
Stryker McGuire, London Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine, on today's announcement by Prime Minister Tony Blair that British troops will begin pulling out of the south of Iraq. Stryker, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it all started with ping pong. 35 years ago today, February 21st, 1972, Richard Nixon became the first American president to visit China, following a group of ping pong players who'd traveled there the previous year. The historic demonstration of what came to be called ping pong diplomacy started with a meeting between Nixon and the communist dictator Mao Zedong in Beijing, attended by a supporting cast of National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger and China's Prime Minister Zhou Enlai. And it ended with a thaw in the deep freeze between the nations and a new global chessboard. It gave the Soviet Union less bargaining power over arms control, even as it frightened tiny Taiwan, the breakaway Chinese government, which never had the same support from the U.S. again. And it made other countries consider public historic encounters. So is there anything we can learn from that meeting today? Historian Margaret McMillan writes about all of this in her new book, Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World. And she joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hello.
Even if you weren't there at the time, you've seen the pictures and we remember the tension, the pageantry, Nixon on the Great Wall with that cloth coat, you know, a wool coat, his wife, Pat Nixon, wearing a red winter coat. Great political theater, even inspired an opera, Nixon in China. But you remind us that the meeting, the actual meeting itself between Mao and Nixon, they had no guarantee as they set off on this trip to China that that meeting would even happen.
It was very brave of Nixon, now I think of it, because he got on the airplane in Washington at Andrews Air Force Base, and the Chinese had said, yes, yes, of course you will meet Chairman Mao, but he had no guarantee. He didn't know until he got to Beijing that he was going to meet Mao. And it would have been, I think, really embarrassing for the American president to go all the way to China and then be snubbed.
Well, put us in that context. Remind us of what was at stake and what was the relationship between the two countries at that time?
The relationship at the time between the United States and the People's Republic of China was virtually non-existent. And it had been non-existent since 1949 when the communists took over. The Korean War, which came in 1950, had seen U.S. and Chinese troops fighting each other. And after that, there was suspicion, hatred, tension on both sides, and virtually no contact. And so what Nixon was doing was really breaking through that long period, as you put it, of a deep freeze, and indicating that he now wanted a friendship with the People's Republic of China. So the symbolism, I think, was probably the most important thing about that trip.
Would it be, for people, younger people in particular, as if President Bush suddenly said, I am going to Iran?
That's the closest parallel I can think of, because what he would be saying if he went to Tehran and met the Iranian president was, look, we may not like each other, we may have very different political systems, and we may have very different ideologies, but there are certain things we have an interest in this case Iraq, in the case of China it was the stability of Asia, and we need to talk.
Further, China at that time in the 72 had also cut off ties with many other countries, had called home its ambassadors to have them, reprogrammed? What did they call it?
Thought reform.
Yeah.
Yeah. We call it brainwashing. But.
Yes. Let's talk about the players as well. Let's start with Nixon. Who was he? Where was he personally and politically at this time?
Nixon is such an interesting man, and I still have trouble making up my own mind about him. I mean, he was an inveterate anti-communist. He'd made his career being anti-communist. He'd had that famous kitchen debate with Khrushchev in Moscow in 1959.
So where they wagged fingers at each other.
They wagged fingers at each other, and Nixon stood up to the communist, and you know, he was known for it. But Nixon was also, I think, very practical, and he was someone who cared deeply about the position of the United States in the world.
And knew more, as you write, and many others have said this as well, really knew more about foreign policy than any president, actually since then, up till Clinton, most historians are saying, and you agree.
I'm getting into trouble for saying that because some people say, what about George Bush Sr. And so on. But I think Nixon really was extremely well informed on foreign policy and he cared about it. In fact, he was bored stiff by domestic policy and bored stiff by economics.
He also cared about his place in history desperately, flop sweatingly, which is, you know, a phrase that comes to mind when people think of his desperate need for what?
He wanted to be remembered like a great leader, like Winston Churchill or Charles de Gaulle. Those were the sort of people he really admired.
Well, as many historians have done when writing about Nixon, there's some psychoanalysis almost, because it feels as if he had maybe more needs than others. A mother who was very cold, as he said to someone, had never said she loved him. It feels as if there was more propelling him to China than maybe was propelling Mao on the other side. And we'll get to him, but there was more driving him.
For Nixon, going to China was a wonderful thing to do. I mean, it showed him at his best. It showed him as a great statesman. He was reversing the previous 20-plus years of American policy. He was making a breakthrough. He was doing something that had the potential to make a huge difference for the United States and give it a counterweight to the Soviet Union. You know, I try and avoid psychoanalyzing Nixon, but it's hard not to. Mm-hmm. He was such a strange man, introverted, and had so few of the qualities you think that a politician needs. I mean, he hated glad-handing, and he hated kissing babies, and he hated being out there talking to people, but he forced himself to do it.
Now, this visit, we should say, was while Vietnam was, winding down, before Watergate? Place it in time.
Vietnam was winding down, or so the Americans hoped, but it wasn't winding down fast enough. Nixon had come into office assuming that he would be able to get the United States out of Vietnam and indicating to the American people that he'd be able to do it. But getting into Vietnam was one thing, getting out was another, and it was very difficult to get out, particularly since, I think, the North Vietnamese scented victory. One of the reasons he went to China, or certainly one of the motives, was hoping that the Chinese would put pressure on the North Vietnamese and help the United States get out.
Then there's Mao. Less is known about him, obviously, than Nixon, but I was surprised to read that he'd almost died just before the meeting. He had medical problems. In fact, his aides hid his medical equipment in a mahogany cabinet in the room where they met. What was his motivation for the meeting?
Mao, I think, was worried about the position of China, and as he should have been, and he'd had a lot to do with leaving it in such bad shape. I mean, the Cultural Revolution had been a disaster.
The Cultural Revolution, turning the young against the old, brainwashing, had been a disaster, but few outside of China knew that.
It was very hard to find out anything about it. I mean, I remember the times that every so often there'd be a picture of hundreds and thousands of young Chinese waving their little red book and getting hysterical about a portrait of Mao, or perhaps even seeing the great man himself. But what was actually going on, we didn't know, because there were almost no foreign reporters in China, and no ordinary Chinese would dare speak to them. I mean, it was just too dangerous. And I think it was only later, and much later, that we realized what disaster the Cultural Revolution had been for China. I mean, all China's universities were closed down, most of its high schools, whole generation wasn't getting educated. People with really important skills that China needed, doctors, engineers, and so on, were sent out to the countryside to learn from the farmers.
Neighbor turn on neighbor, child turn on parent. People were killed for the slightest indiscretion. Do you think, had Nixon known more about that, he would have been able to go?
It would have been, I think, politically much more difficult for him if we had known what was going on, because people would have said, what is he doing talking to a man, Mao Zedong, who has done such awful things? On the other hand, Nixon was very practical, as leaders of countries have to be, and I think he was prepared to deal with people who he knew were dreadful dictators. I mean, he was prepared to deal with the Soviets, and by that point, the United States had a pretty good idea of what the Soviet system was like. But he simply saw it as in the interest of the United States to have an opening to China.
And that opening started 35 years ago today when Nixon, as you said, met Mao in Beijing. Well, when we come back, what happened during that meeting that changed the world? Author Margaret McMillan says, not very much. We'll have that. But also, quick reminder, later in the program, a look at the coming robot soldiers, names like Botpack, Bobcat, Gladiator. That's still ahead after a quick break, here and now. It's Here and Now. Later today, actor Danny Glover. But we're back now with historian Margaret McMillan. Her new book, Nixon and Mao, details President Nixon's historic trip to China, which started 35 years ago today in 1972. The Nixon visit followed the so-called ping-pong diplomacy episode of 71. We want you to remind us about that. But first, the actual meeting between Nixon and Mao. Well, it sure didn't turn out to be much more than a photo op, did it?
When I started to do the work of my book, I thought, well, that'll be the centerpiece of my book. There'll be this amazing conversation between these two great world leaders. And when I actually read the conversation, because there's a transcript of it, I thought, this doesn't amount to all that much. I mean, you have Nixon, who was very well prepared, and he brought all sorts of talking points, and he had very serious things he wanted to say, and he would launch into one of these disquisitions on, for example, the Soviet Union, and Mao would sort of wave a lordly hand and say, no, I'm not interested in that sort of thing. Let us just talk in more general terms. So it wasn't really a substantive conversation. I think the important thing about it is that it took place at all.
We have to bring in the two supporting actors in this scene, Chou En-lai and Henry Kissinger. Give us a paragraph on each, you know, where they were in this picture.
Both of them were perhaps the two greatest diplomatists of the 20th century. I mean, they were both marvelous negotiators, and they had that sheer patience and determination and stamina that you need if you're going to sit there for hour on end negotiating, which they both were capable of. Both worked out and carried out the will of their masters. I mean, not that Henry Kissinger or Zhou Enlai were stooges in any sense, or not that they were subservient, but they simply bowed to their superiors. I mean, it was Nixon's initiative, in my view, that really got the United States going to China.
Do you think Henry Kissinger feels that way?
My own impression is that it was Nixon who wanted to do it and Kissinger who came on board, because there are accounts that when Nixon first said, look, I want to try and find some way to talk to the Chinese, the Red Chinese, Kissinger came down the hallway and said, I don't believe it. The president wants to recognize Red China. I think he's taken leave of his senses. When he realized Nixon was serious about it, he bent his very considerable talents to making sure that it came about.
Right. Well, so as you said, the meeting, first of all, happened sooner than anyone thought. They'd just gotten there and they're whisked away in, I think, kind of a funny scene where everybody's going, oh my God, they just took Nixon in the car, and off he goes to this meeting with Mao. Then your book, you know, proceeds from there. So what else was there? Why is this week, why was it so important to history? What else happened that makes people think that this was the week that changed the world?
I think there are two really important things here. One is the symbolism of it. I mean, simply seeing an American president, the first one ever, in fact, standing there in Beijing, standing there in the Forbidden City, exchanging toasts with Zhou Enlai, each toasting the health of the others.
Well, and I have to jump in and standing in an empty city. How weird. I mean, as you write, the reporters were all looking around. They couldn't see anyone.
Well, the first day that the Americans arrived, the Chinese authorities apparently had told the people of Beijing, do not make a fuss when the Americans appear. Do not crowd into the streets. Just go about your business. And I think that was partly because no one really knew when the meeting with Mao and Nixon would take place. And no one was sure among the Chinese what Mao's own reaction was going to be. And so the first day, the Americans were shocked by how cool their reception was. Haldeman, H.R. Haldeman, who was Nixon's advisor, looked down a side street at one point as the cavalcade went through the streets and saw the police holding back a crowd of passers-by. And I think this was a very Chinese thing. They didn't want to look impressed by the Americans coming. But after Mao and Nixon had met, the next day, all the Chinese newspapers had photographs of it, and there suddenly was a lot more attention paid to it. But the Chinese had lived through such repression, particularly with the Cultural Revolution, that they weren't going to do anything the authorities didn't want them to do.
You, as an historian, you look back, but I wondered if you would just look in present time. I mean, many would say there are still human rights abuses in China, much work to be done. But did that visit, was that the turning point or a tipping point in tipping China away from the Cultural Revolution towards more human rights?
No, I don't think that visit itself did it. I think what followed did. I mean, as long as Mao was alive, and he didn't die until the fall of 1976, the policies which he had put in place during the Cultural Revolution were going to remain. But when Mao was dead, there was a brief sort of power struggle, and then Deng Xiaoping emerged as the chief figure in China, and he immediately began to undo some of the worst policies of the Cultural Revolution. But the Chinese leadership has always loosened the repression on economic activity, but they're still very, very tough on political and free speech activity. And so they remain a very authoritarian state. And I think it's unlikely that they're going to change anytime soon.
Well, what can we learn from this? You know, what can we learn from this visit 35 years ago? And I'd mentioned, would it be the equivalent of George Bush going to Iran? And if that were the case, if you're saying that China didn't change its human rights policies, what else could a visit like that do today?
Well, what the visit to China did was begin to bring China back into the community of nations. And that, I think, was very important. It no longer remained, as Nixon had once expressed it, in angry isolation. It now became part of the community of nations. As far as President Bush going to Iran, I think it's very unlikely, and I think it's very unlikely he'd find, at least at the moment, with the present president in Iran, anyone who'd want to talk to him. But I think what the Nixon visit shows is sometimes you need an act of statesmanship, and sometimes you need someone to say, look, this situation is absurd. We have gone on long enough not dealing with each other and not talking to each other. The time has come to try and make it different.
And we said that it started with ping pong. Remind us?
There were all these sort of straws in the wind that the United States and China were beginning to modify their stance towards each other. And one of the really crucial ones came in the early summer of 1971 when an American table tennis team, a ping pong team, was playing at a world tournament in Japan, and there was a Chinese team there as well. And one of the Chinese players chatted to one of the American players, and then an invitation came from the Chinese team saying to the American team, it would be nice if you came to China and played ping pong with us. And from the American point of view, this was amazing. This was the first official invitation to an American to come to China since 1949. And so this bewildered table tennis team, ping pong team, found itself in the middle of a major diplomatic incident. And they went trotting off to China. They played a few games with the Chinese, who, of course, were world champions and much better than the Americans. The Chinese players were told by Mao himself to lose at least one game to the Americans. And they found themselves at this huge reception given by Zhou Enlai, the prime minister of China, where he said, I drink to the future friendship between our two peoples. Most of them were kids. I mean, there was, you know, they were teenagers. I'm not sure they fully realized what they were at the center of. But it was an extraordinary indication that things were beginning to thaw.
Message sent through ping pong. Margaret Macmillan's new book is Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World. Thanks so much for speaking to us on the 35th anniversary of that meeting. Thank you.
Well, it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
And a quick note about tomorrow on Here and Now. A new study says the war in Iraq is creating terrorists, foreign fighters, and other countries are bracing for these fighters to return home. Also, for a healthy body and mind, go take a nap. We need a nap room here. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Danny Glover's still ahead Here and Now. Funding for Hearing, it's Here and Now. In Star Wars Attack of the Clones, Jedi Knights and Clone Warriors do battle with an enormous robot army.
Around the survivors in Perimeter 38.
Well, that may have happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, but using robots in war is not science fiction anymore, and the military has big future plans for them as well. Joining us is journalist Steve Featherstone. He attended trade shows where the latest prototypes were on display. He spoke with manufacturers and military experts, and he's written a cover story for the February issue of Harper's Magazine called The Coming Robot Army, Introducing America's Future Fighting Machine. Steve, you've seen many of these machines. They come in so many shapes and sizes, names like Bobcat, Packbots, Throwbots, Gladiator. Fill us in. What's the range of military robots now in development?
Well, you've got two classes. I mean, you have ones that fly and ones that go on the ground. And among those, the ones that go on the ground can range from anything from something the size of a paperback book that has a little camera attached to it that you can skitter up a wall and look around a corner, to something about the size of an armored golf cart. And in regard to the ones that fly, you're looking at something about the size of a remote-controlled airplane that you could get at any hobby shop, to something the size of maybe like a private jet.
Well, you describe planes that are slung from catapults and bungee cords, shot from pneumatic guns, and the backs of pickup trucks simply tossed in the air, and also, you know, robots that are sort of like a soldier's, you know, pet dog paddling along behind a soldier. But are these real, or are they just, I mean, they're real, but are they real in that they're just in the demonstration stage?
Well, some are in demonstration stage, but there's quite a few that are being used in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. The first UAVs, that's the unmanned aerial vehicle, were used in the first Gulf War, and there was just a handful, maybe less than a dozen. And they were used in the Balkans, and now with the since 9/11, the industry has exploded because the military has seen just how useful they are. Mind you, they're mostly used in a surveillance capacity. That is, these are robots that don't have guns or missiles attached to them. Some of the robots that I saw there these are prototypes, mind you, did have weapons on them. They were weaponized. One of these that is fairly close to going into combat is called the Swords vehicle. It has a kind of a theatrical name. It's the Special Weapons Observation Reconnaissance Detection System.
What does it look like?
It's got two tank treads, and it has a very simple arm on it that ordinarily would be used to defuse explosives. That's what they originally were used for and still are used for quite a bit in Afghanistan and Iraq. So some soldiers that were part of an explosive ordnance team down at Picatinny Arsenal, New Jersey, took the arm off of it and said, well, we can put a machine gun on this thing in addition to a camera. And once you do that, you can pilot this robot around the battlefield, and it just crawls over the rubble, and it does quite a good job of it. And you can seek out a target, and you're basically looking at a laptop with a screen. You're looking at exactly what the machine gun is pointing at.
Well, some of these robots that you've gotten to see are being made by industries we're sort of familiar with. I'm thinking of the PackBot, made by the same people who make the Roomba robotic vacuum cleaner. A rep tells you if you can operate a Game Boy, you're good. So there's this whole, you know, younger generation of video game players thing about it.
The manufacturers are not shy at all about who they're marketing these things for. I mean, we got to remember, the average soldier is probably, you know, 19, 20 years old. They grew up on video games. They play video games on base in between combat patrols and whatnot. And so, you know, picking up a controller and operating a device is nothing to these guys.
Well, what are people saying to you about this? It's not an entirely new world, as we said, but the coming world of robotics at war. I mean, you say that there's a sort of a two-prong approach to it.
Let's put it this way. The way that the robots are being marketed by manufacturers and the way that the Army is portraying the robots that they hope to soon field, in addition to the ones that they're fielding now, is that these robots will take the soldier out of harm's way. And who would not want that? At the same time, the Army really didn't want to broach the idea that one day these robots will autonomously, that is, on their own, seek out and kill human beings.
So while they liked the idea of machinery that was going to save Marines, save time, save manpower, save lives, as someone said to you, they were wary of something messing up and a robot killing a human by mistake.
Yeah, well, I think the assumption is, at least for the folks I talked to, and it seemed rather short-sighted to me, was that robots would never, ever be out of human control. And given the trends that drive military technology, which are whatever takes our people out of the way, we're all for it. And if you take that to its logical extreme, you know, you've got robots that are basically doing the heavy combat.
Well, and this raises a lot of questions. First of all, you know, how much is a machine like this an extension of your army? I mean, what are the ethical questions of having armed robots?
There are no legal prohibitions about robots killing human beings. That's perfectly legal within the laws of war and the laws of armed conflict. However, I think there's some ethical problems with this. An international scholar that I talked to, an international humanitarian law, put it best, I think, when he said that the more distance you put between yourself and the act of killing, it lowers the threshold for killing in the future. That is, we should always have the shock and horror of killing another human being fresh in our conscience. It shouldn't be something that we're distanced from. Otherwise, it just makes killing that much easier. It really lowers the threshold. And I think robots really do that. They lower the threshold for killing, and they also lower the threshold for going to war. It makes it much easier to use robots than it does to send soldiers. There's no political cost to that. There's going to be no grieving robot mother outside the president's ranch gates when the robots get killed.
And what is the long-term thinking about the robots? How much money is being allotted to them? What's the thinking, you know, about making them a further reality?
Robots are part of a broader modernization program called Future Combat Systems for the U.S. Army. And the Future Combat Systems comes in at about $160 billion, which is the largest military program in history. Yeah, no, robots are here to stay. They have a real utility, and they're not going to go away. However, there has been, because of the cost of the war in Iraq, a few cutbacks in the Future Combat Systems. They're putting a few of the robots on hold. They're not eliminating them. They're putting them on hold so that maybe in the future it'll be picked up again. But the cost of the war in Iraq is really putting a huge drain on what the Army can do.
That's Steve Featherstone. His cover story, The Coming Robot Army, Introducing America's Future Fighting Machine, appears in the February edition of Harper's Magazine. And we have this quick note from the entertainment world. The music industry is warning colleges to crack down on students who are illegally downloading music over university computer networks. The Recording Industry Association of America said the number of students breaking the rules has tripled since last year, and they identified 15,000 students at the top 25 offending colleges. Now, universities are policing students. At the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, third-time offenders lose their internet connection and are sent to the dean for additional punishment. Under federal law, universities that receive complaints about students illegally distributing copyrighted songs generally have to act to stop repeat offenders, or the schools can be sued. The entertainment industry says they can only do this if the schools help them correlate the information and track down the kids. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, we're about to speak about a grown-up word that's being used in a children's book and has caused quite a kerfuffle. Are you ready? Okay, the word is scrotum. There, we said it. That wasn't so bad. But apparently the use of the word that defines a male body part in a non-sexual way in the book The Higher Power of Lucky has led to the book's banishment from some libraries, even though it won the prestigious Newbery Award. Well, Sherry Eskin is a librarian at the Honan Alston Library here in Boston, and she's joined us in the past to talk about children's literature, so we invited her back. And Sherry, let's talk about the use of this word in the book by Susan Petrone. She's also a librarian. Tell us a little bit about the storyline, and then if you would just read the passage where it's used.
Sure. Well, Lucky lives, she's 10 years old, and she lives in a tiny little town in California. And she's had sort of a difficult childhood. She's being taken care of by a guardian right now. Her future is very unsure. She has a couple close friends, but she really feels throughout the book that she wants to find her higher power that's going to guide her and make things clear for her. And one of the things that she does, because there's not much going on in her town, she eavesdrops on Alcoholics Anonymous meetings through a hole in the wall.
And in the very opening of the book, she's doing just that. She's listening in, and this is what she hears. Let's hear.
Sammy told of the day when he had drunk half a gallon of rum, listening to Johnny Cash all morning in his parked 62 Cadillac, then fallen out of the car when he saw a rattlesnake on the passenger seat biting his dog Roy on the scrotum. Lucky balanced herself with a hand above the little hole that short Sammy's voice was coming out of. With her other hand, she lifted the way too curly hair off her neck.
So we have this image of this little girl listening through this hole to this AA meeting, and I can just hear some parents saying, what? An AA meeting? An alcoholics? I mean, I didn't know that was in kids' books.
But actually, there's a lot of difficult stuff in kids' books, and this story actually does it very well.
Well, some librarians who are objecting to this book, they say they're not banning it. They're simply making a purchasing decision, as they do for any book.
Because it's a Newbery book, everyone would almost definitely have this book on their shelf. Every school library is really expected to have a full selection of Newbery books, every public library. I mean, they say that little tiny libraries in the middle of nowhere really don't have a lot of money and have to make these very serious decisions. I think this book is such a good book and deserves to be bought. To not buy it because of one word used a few times seems to me to be such a mistake. And I think using the medical term, and because she comes back at the end and asks the woman who takes care of her, her guardian asks her, what does this mean? And can you explain this to me? I think it's a great way for kids to learn what this means.
Well, in a New York Times editorial today, the paper noted that some librarians were suggesting that if teachers were to read from the book in class, they should replace the word with a throat-clearing noise. You know, the dog was bitten on the What do you think?
I could see that reading this might lead to 45 minutes of hysterical laughter and being unable to bring your class together. On the other hand, if you're a good teacher or a good librarian, this is a good opportunity for you to say, you know, this word is a medical term and we can talk about this right now and we can spend a whole class period talking about what this means if you really want to, but this is a great story and we need to get past this.
Is that perhaps the problem, that a parent might not want their child to have a body part defined, you know, in a reading session in the classroom without them there?
I think that might be a problem, but I think it's a good opportunity. And I think if parents have a problem with it, parents need to discuss these things with their children first so that their children are, you know what all of these things are. And by 10, you should probably know.
This book is recommended for 9 to 11, we should point out. Would you, when parents are checking it out, would you give them an advisory as a librarian?
I wouldn't. I think that children who read this, if they have questions about it, would hopefully go to their parents.
Really, you wouldn't warn someone just so they, you know, so that they're prepared. I mean, it's right there on the first page. Let's say they're settling in that night with their kids. You know, they open this award-winning book, and right there in the second paragraph, what if a parent's just not prepared at that point?
I would hope that parents would come back to me. And if they want to come back to me and talk to me about the fact that I didn't say anything to them, I would be happy to have that conversation with them. But I would rather they take the book home and give it the chance that it deserves because it's such a good book, rather than me saying, by the way, it has this word on the second paragraph, and them saying, oh my God, I don't want to take it home. So I want them to at least give it that chance without me ruining it for them right away.
Sherry Eskin, librarian at the Honan Alston Library here in Boston, speaking to us about The Higher Power of Lucky, a book that, as we said, is stirring some controversy. Some librarians want to ban it because it has the word, okay, we'll say it again, just one last time, scrotum. Sherry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Actor Danny Glover is next. His new film takes a look at poverty in Africa. That's still to come, Here and Now. This book is recommended for 9 to 11, we should point out, by the author. And It's Here and Now. Agony in Africa is a popular cause for Hollywood celebrities these days, but still, third world debt isn't the stuff of blockbusters. Well, actor Danny Glover is hoping to change that. A longtime supporter of Africans making their own films, he's teamed up with Malian director Adoraman Sesako to produce Bamako. Bamako dramatizes the consequences for countries crippled by debt. A singer in the film laments that poverty is driving her from her homeland of Mali. It's a surreal courtroom drama. On trial, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, which made the loans that in real life celebrities like Bono say should be forgiven. Danny Glover appears in the film without saying a word, although he had plenty to say when he visited Boston recently to introduce Bamako at the Museum of Fine Arts. And that's where Here Now's Virginia Prescott caught up with him to talk about debt, politics, oh, and by the way, befriending Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
I want to just make sure our audience really understands the premise of the court, the trial that takes place in the courtyard. It's citizens who are talking about how their social lives and their social programs have buckled under the debt of the IMF and the World Bank.
Transportation, the privatization of transportation, right. The railway.
Electricity, all of these services.
School teachers.
But instead of being, you know, these heads of NGOs in Brussels or in London, this is regular people.
These are people who are impacted, the voices that you never hear, who suffer from these this structural adjustment through what Paul Farmer and others refer to as structural violence, you know, that are imposed upon countries upon receiving IMF loans or World Bank loans. What's so wonderful about this film is that certainly there's a narrative in there, and unconventional as well, narrative in which you get a sense of the life around this courtyard.
It is amazing. People walk through the courtyard. They walk around the courtyard.
They're
picking up children. They're doing their wash. They're listening to things. They're taking naps.
Yeah. And it's really wonderful to see all these things happen and then people testify. But you hear their voice front and center. But these weren't actors who were given testimony. He listened to the old man sings his lament of a farmer. It's a southern dialect that very few people are able to translate. Adoraman made a creative choice saying that it was most powerful. You don't have to know exactly what the words are to know what it means.
No, you don't for this. Yeah. And let's get a sense of that. We can listen to the scene now. So you play a cowboy along with the Palestinian director Ilya Suleiman. It was quite a surprising little scene. It's a kind of a surreal film in a way that this whole conceit of the trial is taking place anyway. But then all of these neighborhood children are watching this spaghetti western, Death in Timbuktu. Mm. Why don't we hear a little bit of that? So you're the good cowboy, and it's obvious in some way that you're mowing down the bad guys who are shooting innocent people.
Yeah.
But what inspired this little vignette? What is it about?
The German did. It's the first movies that he saw, the first American movies that he saw were Westerns. The idea of the Western is a metaphor for a number of things. The dominance of the West and the dominance of Western culture, but also the fact that the Western, this particular Western, chooses to kill women and teachers. As I said, get the teachers to kill the teachers. And metaphorically, that's what happens in this new global arrangement, that the ones who die a slow, a painful death are children, women, and teachers. It's not all just Europeans, but Africans play a part in this process as well, this robbing of the African people as well, the backdrop of the trial itself.
Africa is kind of in right now, especially in Hollywood. We're seeing more films like Blood Diamond, for example, this year, The Constant Gardener, people adopting or having babies in Africa, making Africa more visible. And there are some, especially in the development field and NGOs, who thinks that that is dangerous for it to be sort of in, like there's a fad. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
As we know, fads tend to be short-lived. It's not the first time that stories of Africa's. Not only did I grow up on Westerns, I grew up on Tarzan films. So Africa symbolized another kind of sense of the dark continent, the natives, the savages, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not the images of Africans. They're African films when they're made by Africans who are telling their own story. Of course, the argument as always is that in order to get an audience to see the film, they need a white star in it. These films give us the action and adventure that are so prevalent in Hollywood films, but not telling us the real story of what's happening with people.
Well, back on the home front here in the U.S., you introduced Hugo Chavez shortly after his comment calling George Bush a devil in front of the U.N. General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a number of sort of searing blog postings about criticizing you for standing up with Chavez, introducing him. Danny Glover is a traitor, T-R-A-D-E-R, which was one of the more surprising ones. But people did seem surprised, as if they couldn't imagine the star of Lethal Weapon having a political view.
One of the things I get tired of is people saying, well, I didn't know you were so political. As if I'd abdicate my responsibility as a citizen once I began to get paid as a character they see and a character that they like. You know, they like Sergeant Murtaugh. People are able to differentiate between me, Danny Glover, as a citizen and me, Danny Glover, as an actor. I don't have to apologize for my embracing of someone who I admire in Hugo Chavez. I embrace him because of what he's trying to do. If I'm concerned about Afro descendants in the region, there are 150 million African descendants in the hemisphere, of which 90% live in poverty. So when I see someone who acknowledges that his grandmother is black and he says, I'm concerned about what is happening in Haiti, I'm concerned about what is happening to the people of Colombia, of African descendants, because of the war on drugs. And so in my sense, in hugging him, was to embrace somebody who I consider my brother. And I'm not afraid to say that he's my brother and my friend.
We've been talking with Danny Glover, the citizen, as well as the actor and the executive producer of the new film Bamako.
Mm-hmm.
Many people still think of you as Sergeant Murtaugh.
Yeah.
And I wondered, given that, have you ever spoken politics with Mel Gibson?
That's not been a part of the relationship I have with Mel. My working relationship with Mel's within the framework of the work that we did was one of the best working relationships that I ever had with any actor. You don't make four films unless that relationship has some sort of trust and transparency. I cherish that and I welcome that, and I don't ask for it to be anything else beyond that. He knows I'm someone who supports the women's right to choose. He doesn't invade my space with his own ideas about that. I'm sure he knows some other things about me, and he's never invaded my own space about that.
Well, Danny Glover, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight.
It's an honor to be here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Here now is Virginia Prescott speaking with Danny Glover about his new film, Bamako. For more on the film, visit our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.